Blog Talk Radio.
What's up, everybody? Getting a little bit of a late start here on the Kay Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. This is Blog Talk Radio / Kay Thompson Live. It's 8 p.m. on Wednesday evening, the 7th of June. A lot of stuff is happening. It's hitting the fan. I am your host. I forgot to say, I'm your host, Citizen Payne, also known as the Sun. Kay Thompson is feeling under the weather, so it's just going to be us and our co-hosts and our guests. And, yeah, today's the day. Well, not tomorrow's the day for the trumpetee and Comey testifying. Let me just say that I don't know if a lot of you people were watching today when they had the other heads of the intelligence agencies on there, but they sure didn't look like they were trying to be too helpful, if you want my opinion of it. I've been saying for a long time that it seems like there's trying to be some sort of like a silent, nonviolent coup, and Trump is kind of operating like things are, like he's trying to be the godfather or something, you know, asking guys to do him favors and and this and that. It's very, very movie-like to me. But unfortunately, it's not a movie for us, right? It's real life. And it's just unbelievable when I think about this period of history, this piece of history during the course of my life that I'm living through. You know, the first black president, as an adult, really making these things and seeing this type of deceit, I guess you can for lack of a better word, presently, going on with the people that occupy the White House now is really kind of unbelievable. It's unbelievable, but it's not believable. But it's not unbelievable. It's reminiscent to me of almost. I don't want to quite say the '60s, but I guess certainly the mentality of some of the people is kind of like the '60s and going through civil rights. And some of the people are working hard to cut back on people's voting rights and working hard to welcome kind of supremacist, white supremacist points of view and perspectives. Let me go on and bring on our co-host, a resident guest. We've got a couple of hosts. Let me welcome Mr. Wayne Gilman, legendary newsman. Wayne, how are you tonight?
All right. I had a little difficulty getting in there. I was getting a little scared, but finally, after the 10th time, it came, you know, I got through. How's everybody?
Everybody is good. It's just us. My mom's feeling a little bit under the weather. We got a couple of people on the hold here. Interesting. Let me also bring in Byron, resident historian. How you doing, Byron Saunders?
Well, it's another blessed day in paradise. You know, we're about to step into. I have to say that with a little bit of humor, because once we hit, like you say, the fan tomorrow, I should want to warn all to stand clear, because there will be lots flying. And some things that you will be anticipating, other things will be totally surprising to you. But, you know, the one factor that is very clear that no one can actually erase from the commentary is that the results of the hack proved that there was collusion all over the place. This goes not just to Trump's administration. This goes all the way up to Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan. I mean, the hack, according to what I've read, was disseminated by the Republican National Party to several states, information that would have influenced the election and political outcomes, not just in Washington, D.C., but in state governor's offices. So this is huge.
That must be some relatively breaking news, because I've been watching you know, these little channels all day, and that's the first I heard that it goes up. I mean, so at the very least, they can be complicit in being in enabling the actions that are being taken by their current party standard bearer, which, you know, is just kind of, you know, it's interesting when you look at these hearings, like particularly today with the various other heads of the intelligence agencies. How, you know, and anytime you see these hearings, you can see how the both sides, I guess, would try to slant their questioning to favor whether they support the person or not. More often, I don't find it as often with Democrats, I find that where, well, let me say this. I don't find it as often with Democrats when the candidate or the people being questioned are clearly have character flaws, if not at least have done something wrong. The Republicans, to me, seem to be a lot more, like I said, enabling of even though they know some of the people have done something wrong, they're still willing to try and make some sort of case or make it right in some kind of way, like the president's statement of talking about he's feeling totally vindicated because Comey said he told the guy he wasn't actually per se under investigation, just that everybody else around him was pretty much. And, you know, to see the spin and then to see other Republicans try to fall in line or throw these softball questions or try to lead the discussion in such a way, it's kind of like last week Devin Nunes tried to announce that he would do a separate investigation from the separate subpoenas, from the subpoenas that Congressman Schiff on the House Side Intelligence Committee was releasing. So it's really kind of funny when you see these guys go through all these conniptions. Let me welcome our guest, too, Mr. Len Gunther, a historian. Been around, I've known him for a long time, but my mom wrote all these notes. But let me just say, I'm not going to read all these notes. I just know Mr. Len Gunther is a noted historian, nationally recognized, certainly across this state of New Jersey. And he's been keeping us reminded and teaching the facts of African-American history for a very long time. How are you, Len Gunther?
I'm good, brother. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear. We can hear you loud and clear, sir.
I'm here. I'm with you. And it's an honor. And I've been a fan of yours for a long time, my brother. And Wayne, I remember you from many years ago.
Yeah.
You sound, you're getting
voice,
younger,
man.
You're getting younger, brother.
I'm trying.
I don't know, man. I don't know what you're eating, brother, but you sound younger.
No,
all right?
I'm hanging out with Eric. That's it. You know, so
Eric comes out of good blood, good strain there, too,
yeah.
Man, you know.
Yeah,
you know, that's
your voice.
Yeah, man, I've been kind of quiet over the last few years, and sometimes you have to take a step back to see the whole picture, man. And you
yes,
know,
sir.
I just want to jump in there and say to my brother Byron, and it's an honor also, and Wayne and Erica. But let me just say this: there's nothing new under the sun. And I'd be very honest, you know, I think that we're living right now in a period where we get immediate information, you know, with press a button and 1,000 channels. But if we go back politically in the history of this country, you know, there was a time when the Democrats were doing the same thing the Republicans were doing because they were in control. They were the slavocrats. They ran the government. They had the House. They had the Senate. They had the presidency. And they could railroad everything. And therefore, you know, before the 13th Amendment, they controlled this country. Before Lincoln was the first Republican president, they controlled this country. And I'm sure that if we look at it from the perspective of the totality of our nation, what the Republicans are doing, and the Democrats are sort of having had to sit on the sidelines because they don't have anything that they can do but a filibuster. This is not nothing new. What is striking is the almost 1984 Orwellian kind of business mentality. You know, I do a lot of lecturing, as you probably know, brothers, and one of the things that I've always distinguished is the difference between authority and leadership. And authority is structural, and it is, and leadership is personal. And many people in positions of authority are not leaders. And unfortunately, we have people who are in positions of authority, but who are not leaders. And you have someone, Trump, who is a businessman who's used to hiring and firing, and thinks that, you know, he can personalize the position and do what he wants, and tell people what he wants, and forget, you know, the just protocol and the dynamics of the structure of the government. However we want to criticize it, you know, there are things that checks and balances, and so, you know, I think that, you know, if we take a good picture and look at it analytically and historically, you know, we as black folks should not be totally surprised. And tomorrow, I don't think we should be floored by what's going to happen, because, you know, we've seen a lot of things happen in our our lives. I'm fascinated also to see what's going to come out. But I was blown away today when I saw all of the heads of the various national intelligence agencies sit before that panel and the government and basically say nothing. Say absolutely nothing. And not only refused to answer the question, didn't get grounds on which they could, and didn't even take the fifth.
Didn't even take the fifth.
They said, I'm just not answering, man. I mean, we're talking about, you know, I grew up 138. We call that Bogarden. You know, we call that Bogarden. They said, you know, why you do that? Because I want to.
And that's true.
You know, because I want to.
Exactly.
You know, why aren't you going to tell us so or what happened? Because I don't want to.
And Lynn, you're absolutely right, because then they call that plausible deniability.
Okay. Plausible deniability, you know. And in the old days, you know, with jury nullification and everything else, you know,
right.
I mean, you know, you could hang a black man with 20 million people watching and a jury saying nothing happened.
Nothing happened, exactly.
You know, ain't nothing happened. You know, there must have been something that caused them to do that before he was hanged, you know. So I'm plausible denial. I mean, you know, the etymology, the use of words, language, but I think what's going on fundamentally is that the media is feeding off. You know, once Trump attacked CNN and attacked the media, you not only attacked a station, you attacked the Constitutional Amendment. You attacked the Constitution of the United States and freedom of the speech and freedom of the press. And when you did that, CNN, if you've noticed, my brothers, CNN has not run any other news since that day when he denounced, his people denounced CNN as a jive station. And they have, I guess you could say, a crusade, and I don't want to make it religious because someone's going to jump on me by that, you know, but they have decided they are going to highlight, and if there's anything that Trump needs to understand is that when the news media, they have some of the best researchers, they have some of the best investigative reporters, and what you've got now happening is a lot of folks within the administration who see the house crumbling and are running for the sidelines, and they are spilling the beans, Jack.
Yeah, they're the informants. They are the informants, and I mean the thing is that needs to continue. And at least I don't know there. I can't say that I pay as much attention to CNN, and I don't mean to cut you off. But, the bottom line is that I think the press has not even gone far enough. You know, I think they've been having fun to a certain extent. And even the extreme right, the Fox News channels and all the others that promote his agenda, you know, they too every once in a while will come under scrutiny and say things that they know clearly that are not true, you know.
Well, we know
that's automatic
about Fox. That's Fox's MO, right? Even with the death and the departure of Roger Ailes,
I mean, it hasn't made a difference. The thing is that one or two of their anchors are, they also know that at some point, especially with the exiting of Bill O'Reilly, anyone could find themselves out of work. And they got it, you know, I mean, it's with so much denial that they could actually throw out there and say this is, you know, this is factual or not factual or fake news and things like that. Even Neil Cavuto, the businessman, took Trump to task today over the tweets. You know, it's about
Today, the head of the Republican head, even the Republican head of the intelligence committees that were interviewing and questioning, they themselves now are in a position where they are now questioning their own president to the extent that, you know, well, the senator from Arizona, what is, I forget his name.
John McCain.
McCain is probably the most outspoken in saying something, and I don't want to get profane, but, you know, if he could cuss, he would cuss right now and say, no, this is wrong, Jack.
Well,
you know,
and
this makes Nixon look like a clown. This makes Watergate look like a clown show.
Right. And he relatively was low key in terms of that, the way he was punching him, because I was watching the hearing too. The way McCain was hitting him was kind of like kind of friendly a little bit, but he was peppering them. So and he didn't,
yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. Some of them softball a little bit, but they can't. And I think that John McCain, I think he most for the most part goes along obviously with the party line, but there's moments when he shows that he's a patriot, you know.
Well, you know what? You know the bottom. You know,
he does, and I know.
He
does, hold on for a second. He does draw a line in the sand, at least, so he doesn't go down with the ship, at the very least.
Absolutely, they're going to jump. But you know as well as I do, it's the midterm elections that are going to be the real deal. Politicians now, we have politicians who don't serve. They serve themselves. They are professional politicians. They don't serve. 98% of congressmen get reelected. And what we got now is they realize that the elections in 2018, the 2000 elections that are going on, primaries now, what we're going to see is a lot of Republicans, I think, really have to confront a lot of these community gatherings, and I think you're going to see a lot of the folks who are not at the top of the ship get hit hard, and that's what's happening, I think, with a lot of what's going on.
That's what's been happening in these town hall meetings. They've been catching it, and I think they're going to catch it even more. Byron, what do you think? Want to jump in there? Brother Saunders?
Yeah, because thank you, and Lynn, you're absolutely right, and what is happening is, and I think it's a strategy the Democratic Party is starting to realize, if they go to those Republican town hall meetings, the confrontation becomes a fact check immediately. It's like you can spin the lie as long as nobody's there to fact check you. But if you have it as a debate in the town hall meeting, and the Democrats are starting to show up at Republican town hall meetings to say, you know what, let's debate this right now. Let's get it on the table. And that's driving the new party, for which the Democratic Party, as Brother Lynn was saying, because back before the Republican Party became Lincoln's party, it was the Democratic Party who ruled the roost. And so
now we
have this reversal of order, and that all happened as a result of the 1964 Democratic Convention, when the Dixiecrats stormed out as a result of Fannie Lou Hamer and the Mississippi delegation challenging the committee. And so we are in a somewhat of a twilight zone itself, but it's all going to play out. It's going to play itself out, and the toilet is getting flushed, y'all.
We are going to see the emperor without his clothing, brother. And I'm telling you, like right now, I mean, I got things to do, but I'm definitely going to turn on TV just to see Comey.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't care if Comey said nothing. I just want to see him come up there and just talk. They've sort of pre-announced it already today, afternoon,
right,
in terms of his writings.
Right.
And so we sort of know what's coming. He kept saying to Trump, no, you're not an investigation, you're not an investigation.
Yeah.
And he had to do that from a professional standpoint. The reality is, though, this man keeps copious notes. He has a history of keeping copious notes. And I don't want to say they've been leaked. I'm saying very fundamentally that he put them out there. And what's going to happen tomorrow is sort of the elucidation of those notes. But you know when you have a president of the United States say, look, man, don't take my man down. I don't want you to take Flynn down. He's a good guy. That's like Adolf Hitler saying to a judge or to a policeman in Germany, look, Goebbels was a good guy, man. Don't go after him, man. He didn't do nothing.
Huh.
Leave the brother alone, man. Leave Goebbels alone, man. He ain't doing nothing, man. You know.
I mean, I'm interested to hear your perspective, Wayne, from a newsman point of view. You know, this everybody's comparing this to Watergate, and obviously Woodward and Bernstein broke that, and the press is coming along slowly. Do you think that they're not moving fast enough? I mean,
I have to agree with both Lynn and Byron. I mean, the thing is that, you know, everything has been eloquent so far in terms of their analysis as to what's going on. And the only thing that I'm concerned about is that, you know, I just wish to a certain extent that the black press was as strong as it once was, you know, back in the day when there was more ownership and it was more cross-pollinization of information from one area to the other, with putting on a completely different perspective. I'm not saying that the black journalist that I see on MSNBC, and I was glad to see that Bill Maher has given up his mantle to Michael C. Eric Dyson to host a show. But again,
oh no, really? I didn't hear that.
I mean, I don't know how long that's going to go, but I just know that for him coming out with the N word, that was the price he had to pay to get off HBO. But you know, the thing is, once you're still coming through that other prism owned by the other party, you know, everything still gets filtered. You know, there was a time when we were in control. And we spoke our mind. I mean, it made politics not right here.
Wayne, let me ask you this. From and also what I want to say that it seemed to be from an ownership, more of an ownership perspective, the newspapers, media outlets. It seemed to be that the black press was more able then to affect the agenda, to be a player in the agenda, like for example. The caucus, Congressional Black Caucus, because of the caucus and the numbers that they have, they are a part of the Democratic agenda in the House of Representatives. And it seemed like back then the black press was more able to do that. Now, you know, they come in, NBC, you know, you had the root.com, right? And when they start blowing up enough, these cats build this website, Black News, they start blowing up enough, then they get bought out by MSNBC, General Electric, to be under their umbrella. So, you guys had back then, you guys definitely had a lot more. The black press, quote, had a lot on the agenda of the discussion, too, from a media standpoint,
yeah.
Right?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Wayne, this is Len Gunther. I wanted to ask you as a newsman, from your perspective, I mean, I'm looking at it, and I have certain feelings about it, but I'd like to know from your perspective, what do you think happened to our press that is causing Eric and Byron and others to say what they're saying? Based upon your perspective as a newsman, what has gone on? I mean, I look at it from the standpoint that our press is no longer our press. But you're right there on the front lines I'm an academic. You're a newsman. What happened? What happened? I want to know. That's what's getting me.
I think really what happened, I can only speak from the New York perspective that, you know, mismanagement, lack of ownership, lack of support. You know, the deal is there were people there who supported what we were doing, and at some point, you know, there's no question that social media had its impact. But even with that, you know, there were certain traditions that were upheld. There's certain voices that you heard consistently. You not only heard them, like, you know, for 3 hours on a weekend, at some obscure hour of the morning or at night, you would hear these voices consistently 5 to 7 days a week, you know, every day, drumming out information that, you know, the information that Byron just came out with earlier in the show, you know, stuff like that, we didn't hear immediately. I mean, I wasn't aware of how far that investigation with regard to the collusion with Ryan and Trump and the hacking and all that business. The deal is that there was timely information that was constantly researched, fact-checked, you know, even before we had use of computers, and it was out there, and it was out for debate, you know? Today, it's a different spin. I'm not saying that we don't get our points across, but it's still filtered, and it's not something that you hear on a daily basis. The minute Obama left office, you noticed that Sharpton's platform was reduced to 1 day out of the week.
I don't even hear his voice anymore.
Hold on a sec. I was just going to shoot out to you, Wayne. Also, it seems like the accessibility to the news, and when you talk about the regularity you're putting out, I mean, you know, LIP, BLS, WWRL, these are stations that people could turn on every day, right? So
right.
The search to find black news wasn't a search. It wasn't a scavenger hunt as it seems to be now, because there's not as many outlets, right? You got to physically get online, go to the website, theroot.com or these other things. It seems more that it's harder to find. And let me flip the question around on you, Len, from an academic perspective, because it seems that the quality of the information that's getting out there, and also just the average intelligence level of, say, the average black citizen in terms of wanting that information or being aware of the news, because I think back then, I'm going to talk about when LIB was really a stronghold. When Wayne, you were there, my mother was there. The academic.
Oh yeah, I was there. I used to be on with your mother, man.
Right, I know that, but I'm saying from an academic perspective. We talked to Wayne from a media perspective, but now let me ask you from an academic perspective. The average level of engagement, intellectual engagement in the issues of the day, seemed to be a little bit stronger back then as well, right?
Well, I think it was stronger then because folks had to read, and they did have, you know, we had something called the press, and we had more outlets. The reality was that there were more black newspapers in the 1880s and 1890s than there are in the 1990s and the year in the 21st century.
Exactly.
During the period of, it is one of the great ironies of our history, that when you look at the history of black journalism and the black press, that there were more African-American outlets in terms of the news than there are today. And that's one. Now, we know that print journalism is suffering, period, across the board. The other side of the coin is that most people get their news now by pressing a button and looking at TV and getting that two-minute blob and that blurb. And when you turn on the news, 99% of the time, what we look at is sensationalism. I mean, I'm not going to pinpoint any one place because I grew up in Harlem. My family came from Jamaica, the West Indies, but I grew up in Harlem as a kid on 138th Street, 119th Street. But the first thing I notice is when I turn on the news, the first thing I do is see murders in the Bronx. And it seems like, you know, like we don't deal with news, we deal with sensationalism. And the other side of the coin is that we're dealing with an immediacy culture. We're dealing with a culture that doesn't want to sit down and talk. The cell phone is not about listening, it's about talking. People don't listen, they want to talk. And the other side of the coin is we lost, interestingly enough, something that we call what I call the sociology of the beauty parlor and the barbershop. When I was a kid, these conversations took place in the beauty parlor and the barbershop.
Exactly.
And brothers was talking deeply about political issues. You know, a sister sometimes thinks brothers talk about sex and think, you go in the barbershop, brothers were talking about Malcolm, they were talking about Martin, they were talking about political issues, Adam Powell and everybody else. Congressman, you see, what has happened is instancy and the depersonalization and the isolation that takes place. The iPhone, the iMac, we have the personal computer. People have seven people in a room sitting together, and everyone is on their own cell phone talking individually and not communicating with each other. And everything is symbolic and it's not literary, and they want blurbs, they don't want to read news. And so what happens is they're getting a short digestion and not anything analytical and deep. Even schools, textbooks, they're no longer using textbooks. Everything is about push-button instancy. So when you begin to have that shortening, whoever controls the visual and the quick media in our society controls the mindset of what people are getting.
Exactly.
Right.
There's one more factor that's added to that.
Let me just say.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Byron. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say there's one more factor to be added to that. The conglomerations who own the media today have literally marginalized our media, our own African American media, because of the advertising dollars, as you know, which drives the market and the industry. The other side of that is because of the people who own the media outlets, Breitbart, Sinclair, Bloomberg, Rupert Murdoch. Think about those individuals alone and the newspapers that they have purchased from across the country, compromising not only local media but FCC laws when it comes to television rights. And then all of a sudden you get a station like NBC who brings on Megan what's her name to interview
right,
Clinton,
right.
And you did you see that was an embarrassment to journalism. That's not
absolutely
journalism. And we get
absolutely
up, and what we end up is getting talking heads who are looking at their paychecks and realizing, oh, I can't compromise my integrity because my paycheck may get stopped if I happen to go against Murdoch. If I happen to go,
and we have
Murdoch
to look at and
hold,
and let us
really,
look at who's
really
paying the piper.
Any, I didn't really hold on for a second. I didn't really expect anything about Megan from Megan and Gert or Greta. I don't really expect
exactly
anything. They have a certain, they got a certain perspective and viewpoint, and that's just NBC trying to widen their audience now because Trump. That's obviously a direct effect of Trump rising to power. They want to get a little piece of that audience. I want to veer off of this a little bit because we only got about a half hour left. I want to get you guys' opinion on the Bill Maher situation. And because, you know, it reminds me, I think about Bernie Sanders when he got hemmed up with the Sisters with Black Lives, because Bill Maher is, seems to be, and from what I've noticed, from my opinion, pro the same issues that most African Americans are for, right? He seems
right
to be
yes
for those issues, and that his usage of that word to me, because I was actually watching the show at the time, I knew he was going to catch hell for it. You know, I chuckled a little bit, but I was like, you're out of bounds, buddy. You know, but to rake him over the coals in such the way it is, you know, he's got to be raked a little bit because everybody's not going to be cool with that. But I think the bigger picture, like Bernie Sanders, when the Sisters stuck up there and took his mic, the bigger picture is to recognize who's really on your side and to keep them from going against you. You know, I mean, it behooves us to really, you know, make our points in terms of our differences and what they've been doing, but not to alienate your allies, and I'm considered.
Let me ask a question.
Hold on, Len. Let me go to Byron first, see what he thinks, and then you can ask your question.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead, Byron.
All right, here's my take on Bill Maher, which I've always considered him to be a closet racist. And I say it in such a fashion because not only did he step over the line, but let me ask the question about Bill Maher's integrity with respect to his attack on Islam, okay? Because at the point at which he used the phrase, I'm a house in, okay? But in context, he was given a chance by the commentaries that night to say our America's number one threat to its national security doesn't happen to be from an outside source. It's racism, white
yes
supremacy in this country.
Yes.
Today is our number one national threat to our national security, peace and harmony, not from ISIS or ISIL or Al-Qaeda, but right in within the walls of our, from sea to shining sea in America. And he refused and won't even broach the subject. But
you
instead,
asked a little bit
it's
too much.
It's the big elephant in the room.
Yeah, let me ask the question because I, you know, I'm listening to you, and I want you guys to tell me because I missed that show. What did Bill Maher? I mean, I followed Bill Maher for years, and Byron, I'm with you on many, many, many levels with that. Could you brothers educate me about what Bill Maher actually said? I know you may not want to say the word, and I always had a problem with us not saying the word. I love Chris Rock, who said, I love black people, but I hate, you know what, and I blah, blah, blah. What I'm asking you is, what did Bill Maher do? What did he say?
I'll tell you exactly. I was watching the show, so when it actually happened.
When did this happen?
This was last Friday. His weekly show.
Okay.
He was talking to Congressman Ben Sass, and I think Ben Sass is from Wisconsin or something, some middle American
Nebraska
place like that, right, Byron? Nebraska. And they were talking about issues and things like that. And he mentioned something about, you know, I got to come out there or Wisconsin or something's a great state. And Ben Sass, yeah, you should come out. We'll put you to work in the fields. And Bill Maher looked at him and said, the fields? You know, and I was thinking the same thing, the fields, and the guy was like, yeah, because they're a farm state. And he said, congressman or senator, I'm a house hand. And everybody kind of like,
oh really?
Kind of laughed a little bit. And he was like, oh, this is a joke, you know. But I was like, yeah, a little bit out of line, you know.
He actually said, I'm a house hand.
Yes, he did. He actually said it, Len.
Were there any brothers on the or sisters on the show?
No,
I don't think that anybody African-American was on the show that evening.
Not this particular.
But
no,
his thing about talking about the fields, I got right. And
yes,
and in my mind, you know, you obviously African American, we go to those places, field Negro, house Negro. So
yeah,
his reaction to working in the field, where did that come from? Was like the same thing that I had, like working in the field. But okay, I mean, but this was white guy to white guy. So I guess Bill had the. It seemed like his reaction would be the same thing that as an African American, if that guy were talking. But then maybe clearly he forgot that he wasn't African American by saying that statement or whatever. Or as a lot of people saying, I'm sure Byron's point of view is that he was too comfortable with it. Wayne, what do you think from a your perspective?
I don't know. I've watched Bill Maher over the years, and I'm not clear on his ethnicity, but I do know that there is an element within the white community that wouldn't tolerate, you know, that coming from an offensive remark being made against their ethnicity with use of a very pejorative term with respect to that. But putting that aside, I've worked with some white folks who are so-called liberals on the air when I was doing the Air America piece. And I think that there's some, and I'm not racist, but they get around us. You have to remember that Bill Maher for many years had a black girlfriend, so I guess he feels, you know, he's one of us because he's
that's a hell of a thing
black.
To think, isn't it?
You know, maybe that's I don't know what it is, but it's like I see the dichotomy, but apparently he doesn't. And I'm not saying that, you know, we all have blood running through our veins, but you have to learn where to draw the line. Ironically, one of the people that he chose to fill in for him before they made the decision to have Dr. Dyson do the takeover was Senator Al Franken. And, you know, I respect the guy. I worked with him a number of years. But I was always amazed, and I'm not saying this with any disrespect, but I used to hear some closet talk about him back in the day with Richard Pryor, and I hear little jokes that used to go on. And you know,
what do you mean by that? Can you explain it to me?
Well, it's just there was a certain discomfort that I felt even when I was in his presence working a shift with him. And there were times when he would look at me, and I guess I've been reading news for 40 years, and all of a sudden it's almost like you faced an epiphany because somebody of my hue can sit in front of a microphone and feel very comfortable doing what it is that you've done, and we're the same age, mind you, you know. And I just, I don't know. It was just one of those things. So there's some who feel because they've had associations with other people and they could come out and say such and such. And ironically, Franken chose not to take the position as fill-in host because of Maher using the N-word, you know.
Right.
But
you know,
but
I think that was more
grandstanding, in my opinion, than anything else, because, you know, once they get amongst themselves, you know, off mic, they have their own agenda.
You know, they've gotten comfortable. You know what? And folks have gotten very comfortable. And what I've noticed is that Bill Maher's show has had his historical I guess you could say the black guests that have always frequented his show. He has his regulars. And he's gotten very comfortable. You know, and of course, you know, Thomas Jefferson had a black girlfriend also, but he was a slaveholder. And he was a pedophile because, you know, she was a young girl, 15. You know, and I always had that, you know, issue, you know, well, you know, some of my best friends are and who I go to bed with. That don't mean a darn thing philosophically and intellectually, you know, as well as I do. And if anything, it may be the highest form of exploitation because of the perception of the black woman and what she may be. But, sexist, racist perception of her that I have problems with. But I think what has happened is that there are folks who have gotten too comfortable. They've gotten very, very comfortable in their, I guess you could say, perception of themselves as being righteous, the liberal. I don't know if he's liberal or conservative. I think he's apolitical. I think he's a everything in the sense that he feels he can throw out anything and doesn't mean anything because his sarcasm and his facetiousness has made him millions. And, you know, he has sort of a nonchalant, cavalier attitude about things.
Exactly.
But I think very simply, you know, we have gotten to the point, though, where we more worry about the N-word than we do worry about the overall socioeconomic dynamic of our people and black males walking the streets and being able to get home without getting shot. You know, I mean,
amen.
I remember, you know, we have spent 300 years wondering whether we're colored, African-American, Negro, capital N small and capital C small C colored. And I think sometimes we get caught up in these things. You know, I've always been fascinated because, you know, I see white guys using the N-word like it means nothing. And, you know,
exactly.
I mean,
as
but, you know, as a kid growing up on the block, and I'm one of these brothers, you know, when I'm walking down the block, nobody knows what I am because of, you know, I've got everything in me. I mean, that's just our people, you know, that's the way we are. But the thing is that, you know, and I know that it's not only the word, it's how it's said, who says it, where it's said, and when it's said. And some people can say it and some people can't. And, you know, I can say it in a certain way and that person knows that's my, you know what. And then I can
right.
say it to another brother and he's like, who you talking to, man? You don't know me. So even among our own folk, you know, there's this folk that, you know, you hear white
That's
folks sometimes
true.
Say, well, y'all call each other that. It don't mean nothing. Yes, it does, because it's about familiarity. And, I mean, some brothers got to the point, and I think this is where the rap artists got in trouble. They started distinguishing between N-I-G-G-E-R and N-I-G-G-A and starting to get so sophisticated in their stupidity that, you know, we've made millions and millions of dollars in the commercialization of our I guess you could say servitude, you know, and it, you know, pain is profitable in America. That's all I want to say. Pain is profitable
pain
in America.
Is, mm. it is that's what it is. And do whatever you have to do to get
it
paid there.
Indeed.
Don't put a point in it there for our guest, Mr. Len Gunther. We want to say thank you for coming on and dropping the knowledge as usual.
Absolutely, brother.
It's been too long.
Love you guys.
Real
honest.
It's great to hear you again. If you don't mind, Len, is there a public number that somebody could, if they want to make contact with you, is there an email site or a website?
Yes, folks can email me. Yes, folks can email me at Len Gunn, LENGUN, Len Gunn at AOL.com, and I'm also on Facebook.
Okay.
Len Gunn at AOL.com is my email. And, of course, you know, that means I'm going to catch all kind of heck. but you know what? You know, my father used to say a black man in America who doesn't think he's crazy is out of his mind. Okay?
You're a revolutionary, brother. So I know
well,
like
you know, I've been out there a long time, but let me just say this, and Eric, I want you to understand this. Your mother is my godmother and my big sister and mentor when it comes to the media, and she brought me in a long time ago with her TV shows. And many years ago, I was on Gus Henningberg's show, Positively
right.
Black, four or five times, a couple of times with Spike Lee. And did a number of shows, but I just want to say that Kay is my big sister and always will be my big sister, who taught me so much about what the media was about when I came on as an assistant, sweeping the floors on her TV show and then moving up to being, you know, sort of an assistant producer until I then went on and had my own show, Impact, on cable. But, you know, I just want to say this to you, that she means the world to me. Wayne, I've been a follower of yours for many, many years. Byron, I'm listening to a brother who I admire, and I'm just honored to be out there and being able to say what I'm saying. And, you know, I've been out here for 50 years, you know, up and down the highways doing various things, leading labor strikes and everything. My father was the president of the Harlem Labor Union between 1940 and 1942 before he went into chaplain in World War II. But he was a member of the Garveyite movement and a member of the African Patriotic League and was arrested 30 times because they couldn't get
wow.
black jobs on 125th Street. So he picketed with Adam Powell and others and the first black bus strike. And you know, long before
right.
Rosa Parks, there was the New York City bus strike in 1941-42.
Yeah.
And that was led by black nationalists and others. Yeah, and I come out of that stream, and that was my father. But what I'm just saying to you, is all praises to you, all praises to Kay, and whenever you guys need me, I'm here. I'm back in the saddle, brother.
All right. Thank you. Thank
all
you.
The best.
Take care.
Thank you,
brother. Take care.
Okay
bye-bye.
Now.
Yes, sir.
Okay now. Bye bye.
And the we got it just in the last couple of minutes. I was going to break down this conversation. Len got me to thinking about the whole system of America and the mythology, the fake kind of government and democracy and all that. But I know that would be too long of a discussion for us to have. We might have to save that for next week. What do you guys think? I think that just the way things we're seeing in the news right now makes you wonder, you know, that piece of paper they call the Constitution, how real is it? How real was it ever meant to be?
Well, that's a whole other story
quick.
By itself, as you said.
Yes, and the civics lesson would take more than one taping, I tell you. Okay, so
absolutely. What do you guys think is going to happen tomorrow? You want to do a little sports commentary, but we'll do a little political commentary?
Sure. I think the Las Vegas odds are already in for the moment. Will tonight's NBA playoff have a larger share than tomorrow? Washington, D.C., I understand, is already setting up morning bars where people can come and watch the greatest show on earth, as it's probably since Ringling Brothers is no longer with us, tune into Washington because it's going to be a hot time in the town. But here's my prediction. What you will hear is an outlay of obstruction of justice. If there is to be articles of impeachment, you're going to have the rationale to create within the Congress, as Congressman Green, Al Green in Texas, has already begun the process of drawing up the papers for article of impeachment. But once again, the House and the Senate are controlled by Republicans. How far it gets will be determined how much evidence comes out that shows obstruction of justice from the White House on down. That's my take.
What do you think? What do you think, Wayne?
Well, I have to agree with Byron. You know that to a certain extent, you know, it's certainly going to be an Armageddon for the party. I really feel that there's enough latent feeling within the Republican Party that if Trump is to be impeached, no love lost, you know, because he made a mockery of the entire electoral process a year ago. But I don't think impeachment is enough because you still have Mike Pence there. I would like to see everything thrown out, scuttled, and I know that has never been done before, but that is I think new elections should be held again, and I think there's enough outrage out there that we would come back with a better outcome as opposed to what we had back in November.
Well, apparently,
I don't know who the candidates would be.
Well, and there's a lot of things that have never been done before, obviously, the way this guy is rolling. From a moral perspective, you know, when it's looking for the articles of impeachment, and Byron, you pointed out that Republicans control both houses.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, from a moral perspective, how long can they ride this out? I mean, do we feel that there has to be do you guys feel that it has to be a smoking gun evidence? Because there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, and everybody around them is contacting the Russians, and there's evidence, there's them on tape, Don Jr. saying we do a lot of good business in Russia years ago. I mean, he said this year before last. You know, now Donald Trump is answering those more salacious questions that came out about him supposedly having hookers in Russia. I mean, how much evidence do they need? Do we think the Republicans are just going to let all of this debauchery slide by their president?
That's going to be determined, Eric, based on their constituents. How much of the erosion of the confidence in their politicians, who have obviously been paid by lobbyists to stand up with corporate America. But when they go back home for the 4th of July, look out, because we've got a hot summer that's in store, and be careful, be extremely careful, because this race issue is at the point of almost exploding.
Oh, of course. I'm telling you.
I would hate to see this summer.
Yeah, from what you're saying, Byron, you know, is that there's a powder keg building, and it's just a matter of time before these cities, you know, go back into that 1960s mode. I mean, I would hate to see that happen, but it may take something like that to bring about, you know, some meaningful change in this country.
What do you mean? Because of the
The confrontations that and the bullying that we are witnessing, and there's nothing coming out of the White House with any sort of compassion when these incidents explode, and they're little brush fires at the moment. But watch what happens now, because you have not just African Americans, and make note of this, all of the protests and the marches, we're the ones who are not even protesting. These are white folks that are protesting and marching.
Yeah.
And that's the point at which when that little piece explodes and it's confrontational, not just in Berkeley or in Oakland, California, but in some of these other cities where weekly Washington, D.C. has had protests and marches almost every week. And it's happening all across the country. And it just takes one spark, guys. And that's why I'm really afraid that – because the administration is so singularly attached to just its own self-reliance and self-indulged pats on the back, they're forgetting that the rest of the country needs leadership and guidance, and we need compassion. When something like blows up and we're about to have hurricane season and FEMA doesn't have money, it's obvious that we're not
FEMA
ready.
Doesn't even have a director, I don't think. They haven't appointed even a director.
And that's the other side. You're absolutely right. Of all of the things that supposedly would guide our government with leadership is that the undersecretaries, the people who you're supposed to hire, they're not in office. They have not hired anybody. And so, therefore, it's a major disaster waiting to happen. And Lord knows the perfect storm can come up
at any time. Yeah.
At any time.
And you know, there's a part of me that thinks that Trump has had enough, and he's just anticipating. You know, there's another side of me that believes that he wants out, and it's got to be something that so monumental that would take him out of here, that would be the end of that, and he can go back to having the life that he once led, and that's it. You know,
but he's also
pure conjecture and speculation on my part.
But he's also the type of individual where he always wants to be perceived as a winner. So I think that out that you're talking about, if he does deep down inside, I have no disagreement with you that he's probably tired of the responsibilities of that job and the restraints as a guy who's used to being the boss, a rich man ordering everybody around, which is why he's behaving like just a total CEO. But I think that he needs to find it a way, like today, saying he feels completely 100% vindicated. Because the comments from the testimony, parts of Comey's testimony that have been released, where Comey told him, no, you're not specifically under investigation. But everybody else around him was, and his staff, and even threw some of his the campaign workers and his surrogates under the bus, right? He said in the statement that you look at, he said if we could find some associates who might have been responsible or something like that. So we're talking about a guy who, like I said before, it takes responsibility for nothing, wants to take credit for everything. So
everything.
If that being the case, I think that he would want to go out in a way where he looks like he's the winner, like he did it for the better of the country, or the Democrats forced him out, or some sort of – it's going to be something made up and some lie to make themselves look good, because that's how they've been running all along. And you know, the whole kind of conspiracy aspect of it. I mean, you got everybody's just lying with him and covering them. And today was unbelievable, seeing those guys refusing to answer those questions because they didn't feel like it. So, I mean, I would love to see him go, too. But like Wayne said, then there's the aspect of Pence, you know? I mean,
I would like
to see these guys get the fullest extent of the law because, you know, it's pretty close to this guy committing treason to win this election.
Well, Pence is guilty of obstruction of justice, and he's going down, too.
I would like to think so. You don't hear much about what's happened with him, but
don't.
You know, but they're both tied at the hip, joined at
That's
the hip.
That's exactly
He was asked to leave the room in both of those conversations, right? In the conversation with Comey, he was asked to leave the room, and then he had another conversation with somebody else where the vice president and another individual asked to leave the room where he wanted to talk to that particular individual personally. So, you know, you talked about plausible deniability earlier, you know, if he's not in the room. But obviously he knew that Flynn was lying, I would believe, to a certain degree, or that there were some lies along the way.
To.
I mean, now there's rumors about Sessions may be resigning, right? Trump's not too happy with him now, you know. And,
right.
and Sessions lied in all of his forms.
Yes, he did.
To get the position. So, and even the guy now, his deputy, who said he would recuse himself from Mueller, he clearly he's in that lot, that succession on that being an accomplice too, with trying to cover up and go along with this whole scam that these guys are trying
to
run.
It's an embarrassment. Wow, it's sad. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, and I was saying earlier, you know, this is one of those historic those times in history where, you know, like the Watergate trial, like the civil rights era, you know, the 60s when, you know, with those images in my mind as a child, but also with the fire hoses being turned on people and things like, of that nature. It's just really to see this and to see a certain portion of the country, I mean, to really see the obvious racism and racists that exist in our country that are willing really to overturn the system just to get what they want, to turn
mm-hmm.
back the clock. And
yeah.
and it's unbelievable. I mean, just real briefly as we go out, I mean, it even permeates, you know, the I don't know if you heard about the little spelling bee controversy when the little girl was being interviewed on CNN by the host, and they asked her to spell a little girl of Indian descent, but American Indian descent. They asked her to spell Covfefe, right?
yeah.
Kind of jokingly. And then the host was Chris Cuomo and this young white woman. And the white woman said, well, its origins are not in Sanskrit, which is, I guess, the Hindu in Hindu religion. She said, so you probably wouldn't be familiar with it. And it's just, you know, a lot of the Hindu people are blowing up because would you say that? Why would you even ask that question? First, ask her
exactly.
to spell
right.
a stupid word that was made up and they were joking around. And she was like, can you give a definition? And they were like gibberish, you know. It was kind of an ongoing joke. But, you know, let the little girl have her moment. But then to make some reference to, like they always do, to someone's ethnicity, it's so embedded in our society. In these people,
yes.
that it really makes me wonder. You know, I see why it's taken us hundreds of years to get to the point.
And that's CNN you're talking about, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
They're main two morning show hosts, and I think Chris kind of picked it up and looked at her and just kind of cut it short and said, "Well, thank you, you know." But you know, I didn't even know what Sanskrit was. I had to look it up. You know, but it's a reference to her heritage, you know.
It's to her heritage.
That she would be, but it's just unbelievable.
And,
but we got to go, guys. Go ahead, Bob.
We
got
to go.
No, go ahead.
Thank you so much. I was just going to say, and that's the inherent problem with America, is that it's racism and white supremacy is overriding just about everything we do. And as long as we don't confront it, it's going to
continue
to be our biggest
exactly.
problem.
Yeah. Get over here on my
Go ahead, Wayne.
No, I was just going to say I concur 1,000% with Byron, and I hope your mom feels better. You know, I miss her voice this week.
Absolutely.
She's getting better. But want to say thank you once again for listening. Everybody, for listening into the Kay Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, blogtalkradio.com/KayThompsonLive. Thanks to our historian, Brother Byron Saunders. Byron, thanks. Once again, for
thank
giving
you.
Your
yes,
unique insight. Thank you,
yes,
sir. I want to say thanks to the legendary newsman. Once again, there he is, Mr. Wayne Gilman. Thanks, Wayne.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks again. We'll talk to you again next week. We want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Kay Thompson Live Show. It's that Wednesday evening, 8 to 9 p.m. hour. You can catch us live. You can also catch all the shows archived, so you can listen to any show you want. Anytime, if you go to Kay Thompson Live, go to blogtalkradio.com/KayThompsonLive. There are all the shows there. We're going to be coming back again next Wednesday evening, 8 to 9 p.m., live for you, talking about the issues, talking about the things that we're concerned about, and move the agenda and the discussion forward. All right, thanks, everybody, for listening to the Kay Thompson Live Show. I'm known as the Sun. Filling in for my mom, representing my mom. She's going to be feeling better. Kay Thompson Live. So talk to you soon, everybody. Take care. Bye-bye.